This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavours, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.
I'm Lucy Hockings from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Across Northern Ireland, on your radio, and on BBC Sounds. This is
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Political parties are calling for the portrait of the former Lord Mayor, Niall O'Donoghue, to be removed from the City Hall. That's the focus of our first discussion on the programme this morning. Then, the LCC, we continue, we pick up where we left off with Nolan Live last night in BBC One. You can see that in the iPlayer. Talking to Jim Wilson, who is a member of the LCC. Excuse me, I've got the hiccups. Former member of the Red Hand Commando. The UVF, the UDA, they're saying, well, where do these people go? Well, is it not obvious where they go? They're saying not. So we look at that this morning as well, and then pat the taxi driver on his teeth and all sorts of madness. That mix is just typical of a day at the Nolan Show. No wonder I've got white hair.
The Stephen Nolan Show!
Good morning. So political parties like the DUP and TUV and UUP and Green Party keeping the pressure on Sinn Féin, and Sinn Féin's response regarding Niall O'Donoghue to agree with those political parties that a portrait of the former Lord Mayor should be removed from the City Hall. Mr O'Donoghue was a councillor from 2011 until 2016. When he was elected as a senator in the Republic, he quit last December, days before Christmas, for what were described as health reasons by both him and Sinn Féin and Mary Lou McDonald. It wasn't true. He had quit, and he very well may have had health reasons, but he had quit because he had sent inappropriate texts to a 16-year-old, as Maria Cahill is describing him, and a 17-year-old, as Sinn Féin is describing this person. And Maria Cahill, last night on BBC One, on Nolan Live, is calling for Mary Lou McDonald to correct the record in the Dáil. So that's a whole other story in itself. We'll be reaching out to Sinn Féin to ask them if they feel the need to do that. This morning, Sinn Féin has told the Nolan Show Sinn Féin agrees that the portrait should be removed. So that's where we are starting off this morning. But how much will such a move affect Niall O'Donoghue? Earlier this week, Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald said this in the Dáil.
In the summer of 2021, Niall O'Donoghue was on extended leave from his duties in the Shannon due to very serious mental health issues. Following the complaint, we were advised that Niall O'Donoghue was again suffering from a mental health crisis and was deemed medically unfit for work by his doctor. As Count Corla, we were very worried that publicly naming him would be dangerous to his health, and that is not to make an excuse for his behaviour, but we had very serious concerns for his mental health and his safety. And I still hold some of those concerns to this very day.
Well, look, Marylou still has those concerns for his mental health, but she is now supporting the portrait being removed of him from the City Hall. Let's get your views this morning. 030 30 80 55 55. Maybe given the fact that he sent, O'Donnell has sent these inappropriate texts, all gloves are off. Maybe that's what you think should happen. But how are the two positions from Sinn Féin consistent? 2 days ago, we hear that they are still concerned for the former Lord Mayor's mental health. 2 days later, they're publicly saying, wipe his presence from existence at the City Hall with regards to that portrait. We've asked the DUP to come on this morning. By the way, I mentioned the UUP. That's my mistake. I don't think they've actually said anything yet. We're checking with them to see what their position is. The TUV certainly want the portrait removed. Their councillor Ron McDowell with us today. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. And Malachy Doherty writes for the Belfast Telegraph. Morning, Malachy.
Good morning. Morning, Stephen.
Morning to you. So, Malachy, you don't think it should be removed. Tell us why.
Well, I think for a number of reasons. One is simply it's part of the historical record of City Hall, the portraits of the mayors. So, if you remove one of them, you're breaking that record. On another level, I think that if you start with the idea that Lord Mayors have to pass some kind of moral test in order to be on that wall, then what about the others? I mean, what's going to emerge later about many, many other mayors of Belfast who may have been guilty of sexual indiscretions, corruption,
no,
lack of probity?
No. We can't.
I'm not naming anybody. I'm not pointing the finger at any specific one. Merely theorising.
Well, I don't think we can theorise about a small group of people. I think it's totally inappropriate and we should not be doing that. So, no.
Let me rephrase it then, if I may. The DUP, for instance, comes out about Christian evangelical culture, which holds a value from the Gospels that one should not, one may not be fit to cast the first stone. And therefore, I think that if they reflect on their own lives, they may find reasons to suspect that others may think ill of them if everything was known about them. And therefore, I think that the precedent of removing a mayor's portrait on stint of a moral judgment about him is a careless thing to do that might reflect on him later badly.
And Councillor McDowell, the reason why Malachy Doherty is talking about a moral judgment is because there's no question of illegality here. The PSNI didn't even start a formal investigation. There was no criminality.
No, we're told that it was inappropriate text to a 17-year-old, which are being challenged with a 16-year-old. But Niall himself said that what he had sent and his behaviour had been inappropriate. He said it was worthy to stand down for, and he said that his own behaviour was less than should be expected. When we talk about the portraits at the City Hall, they're described as an asset to the city, and they also tell the social history of the city for tourists, for visitors. Belfast City Hall is the jewel in the crown. And when we're telling the story of some of those portraits, people like Sir James Johnson, whose portrait was badly damaged during the Blitz, people like Kate Nicholl from the Alliance Party, who got her portrait taken when she was pregnant, what's the story we tell that represents and portrays Belfast to the world when we come to Niall's portrait? It's right that the portrait's removed, and there are real serious safeguarding issues around children. If there's concern about Niall's mental health, then it's been brought on by Niall's behaviour. And unfortunately, it's the right decision that the portrait gets removed.
Malachy.
Who sets the moral test? Who's the moral arbiter of who's fit to be on the wall of the City Hall? I mean, the people of Belfast voted him in as a councillor. The council selected him as a mayor. If they regret that decision, then they regret that decision. Fair enough. But who's the moral arbiter that decides that one mayor can go up on the wall and another can't? Niall O'Donnell is... place in history is established now. It will be a chapter in itself in the book of the rise and fall of Sinn Féin. So, I mean, people are going to be curious about this man in the future because of the part that he has played in these quite monumental political events. So really, I mean, I think, essentially, I think the DUP and unionist they want to have a go at this. They want to take their bite out of Sinn Féin. They're entitled to do that. That is what they want to do. But they don't want to do it in the Assembly because they don't want to jeopardise the Assembly. So they go for some kind of tokenism that signals to their own support base that we're on to this and we're dealing with it and we're having our say on it. But so they go for something that's negligible, that's tokenistic, and is really quite moralistic and silly.
Well,
everybody's behind it, so I've lost the argument, but fair enough. But I still think you're making yourselves ridiculous.
It's certainly not a tokenistic response from TUV, because nothing that you've said at the outset there can be accused towards TUV. The TUV put in a motion to have the portrait removed. That motion was to go before SPNR yesterday morning. It was then reciprocated late last night when Gavin Robinson met with the DUP councillors and said that they would bring it up at the party leaders that the portrait should come down. Don't forget, the lads and the people, or the lad that he has been messaging is still knocking about out there. We don't know the full fallout of this. And I think to protect Belfast City Hall, protect the integrity of the councillors, it's the right decision that it comes down. But we do agree on what you said around the Assembly. TUV put forward also a motion of no confidence in Michelle O'Neill and her behaviour around all of this with Michael McMonagle and also the questioning that was taking place around Sinn Féin at the time. The DUP, you're right, wouldn't sign it. The Ulster Unionist Party wouldn't sign it. So are they happy? And we need to hear from them again. Are they happy with Michelle O'Neill's handling of all of this?
Well, you know they're not.
Well, they obviously have confidence in her because there's a motion of no confidence that they can sign and they won't sign it. So again, I think Mal's right that there is politicking. They're going for this little small minnow of a tokenistic bringing down of a portrait when really they can challenge bad decision-making, accusations of cover-up from Sinn Féin and demand proper interrogation of government.
Well, you haven't said it, but what you want is the collapse of the Assembly.
Which is what he's always wanted.
That's what you're at, isn't it?
The collapse of the Assembly is a consequence of poor governance and poor leadership from Michelle O'Neill. That's how the system is set up. The system is set up where you can't challenge those in power now. So if we have no confidence in the behaviour of a governmental minister or the governmental first minister on this occasion, we have no grounds to challenge that.
So every time there's a crisis in a political party, you think it is good for Northern Ireland that the Assembly collapses. You see, you go beyond that. You don't want the Assembly up at all.
No, the Assembly is set up, built upon institutions, and this is how they work. It's a flawed institution. And if we can't raise serious questions around safeguarding of children, about child protection issues, because it might upset the system, or there might
but
be a flaw in the system.
But there have been serious questions. You cannot argue that running parallel to the Assembly continuing, there have been serious questions for Sinn Féin every day of the week over the last few weeks. The Nolan Show's done 90-minute programmes on it.
And they've perpetually refused to answer them. Our own MLA, who was cut down to 30-second segment of questions. What did Sinn Féin know? When did they know it? What action did they take around these issues?
I think you should stand back and enjoy the show. Because it's the Sinn Féin electorate who are going to decide this issue. There's a general election coming in the South. Sinn Féin's prospects are looking fairly shaky now in relation to that. If the party feels badly in that election, then Mary Lou's leadership is in question. If Mary Lou's leadership is in question, then a new leader might wish to have a different deputy. You could see Michelle O'Neill out of work by January, you know. Stand back and let it all happen and enjoy it.
But is that how absurd Northern Ireland government is at the minute now, where
can't
challenge government,
so
we have to rely on Dublin government to challenge failure at Stormont? We should have that power ourselves.
Well, you don't. I mean, there are failings. There are flaws in the whole system of power sharing. And there are political parties. I think both the SDLP and the Alliance Party have put forward ideas for the reform of those institutions. And those institutions ought to be reformed. You know, because of the double veto within them, because of the inability of an opposition to bring down another party other than by walking out. All those things are problems, and I agree with you on that. But I think in relation to this particular issue, of Neil O'Donnell. You know, the party is dealing with it. Tokenistic efforts, and you picked up that word from me as well, and you use it as well, like demanding the removal of a portrait, are trite and silly ways of dealing with it, and they're moralistic ways of dealing with it. The political fallout that is happening now is historic and monumental, and will change the political frame, probably in the north as well as in the south. I think these are amazing times. I think you're entitled to have your say on it. I think you are entitled to oppose the structures of the assembly or the concept of power sharing altogether, if you wish. But I think that you're vulnerable to the charge that you would be making this case over anything at all, because you fundamentally just don't want power sharing.
And that comes back to the point then that we can't challenge anything at all. Because if you're saying that we can't say that we don't have confidence in a government minister because it would bring down Stormont, well, where's democracy in that? The very foundation of democracy is to challenge power and authority. And if we can't challenge power and authority and say we have no confidence in you, then where do we stand? A month ago,
The only resort that's available to you, unfortunately, is the electorate.
The Green Party councillor, Brian Smith, joining us this morning as well. Good morning to you, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. Your party's also calling for the portrait to be removed. Why?
Stephen, we spoke about this last night, just in light of the DUP going public on this. We think it is appropriate as well, and just in terms of there's questions being raised here about the... They're 16 or 17, I think that needs to be clarified. It's interesting to see as well that his former party have also called for, they're happy enough for the removal of this. I think that, I'm looking at this, I work with young people in the care system, I deal with child sexual exploitation, I deal with safeguarding issues on a weekly basis in terms of my role outside politics. I think it's important for the council maybe to be setting here as a thing we take seriously.
I think it's very, very important to state that there's no illegality here, even being remotely suggested on the part of Niall O'Donnell. What he did was not illegal. The complainant, and it is my understanding that the recipient, should I say, did not make a formal complaint to the police, that the police approached that person, that the police had a conversation, and that young person did not want to make a complaint. So there hasn't even been an investigation into this, Brian.
No, Stephen, I think you're right, but I think you highlighted something here, that whilst this debate at the minute is based around Niall O'Donnell's and to be dead, and we're unsure, but there's a young person at the heart of this who's been lost in this debate, and I want to thank them for being brave and for raising this issue. But I think that there are so many other people out there, young people across Northern Ireland, who are maybe dealing with issues, who are maybe living in fear. And I think that we need in the short term, at very least, that this portrait needs to come down. We need full clarification of facts. We need to know exactly what's going on. And I think it sends an appropriate signal. As I say, I think for me, I want to take the politicking out of this, that this should be about safeguarding. This should be about child protection. That they, for me, are the fundamental processes.
Could you not just pass a motion of censure through the council? And let the council express its disappointment or its revulsion of what he's done, you know?
Well, we could do, Molly, but I also think that this, just in terms of, I think, that the public mood as well, maybe there's a lot of people deeply uneasy about this. There are a lot of people out there that may be triggered and are dealing with issues. I think that I would be saying to people, that there are areas out there for people to talk to. There's a domestic and sexual abuse helpline. It's 0808 802 1414. There's Childline 0800 1111. I think we've got to look at this way. Now, there may be people here that this is traumatizing or re-traumatizing, and I think that we need to be supportive. And I think that, this is very uneasy, and I understand where Maliki's coming from. But from my point of view, just in terms of, as I say, taking the political hat off this, looking at this through child sexual exploitation and also a safeguarding issue.
But you don't know. Look, my job is to make sure that we stick to the facts this morning, right? Nobody knows what was sent.
No, we don't. But I do think that it's been serious enough.
Nobody knows. Nobody. Look, Sinn Féin are saying it was, it was inappropriate. Niall O'Donnell is saying it was inappropriate, but it wasn't so inappropriate that Sinn Féin made sure that, you know, his money was stopped immediately.
Well, I think there's a question.
But there is also a question, Brian. Around here we are. We're talking about the Niall O'Donnell. Mm-hmm. We don't know what he sent. Should we know? Is it important that we do?
I think it has to be dealt with very sensitively, but I do think that there's more questions here to be asked and to be answered, because I think Maria Cahill Reyes last night disputed the age of this young person. So I think for a start, that needs to be looked at. And if this young person is 16, does that change the game in terms of the legalities?
No, it does not, because the age of consent in Northern Ireland is 16.
But what about in the Republic? Maria Cahill has raised this morning about the Republic.
She has, but again, you see, what's happening here is because people don't know, and I am not defending Niall O'Donnell or indeed Sinn Féin. I'm not. Mm-hmm. What I am saying, Malky O'Doherty, yeah, is there are lots of things which we don't know. We
Absolutely.
Do not know what was sent. We there's Brian introducing now, well, yeah, if it was sent in the Republic. We don't know that it was.
No.
And by the way, nor do the police, because the police haven't investigated it.
Yeah. And we're taking the word of Sinn Féin for a lot here, you know. I mean, they may have looked at Niall O'Donnell and thought, God, this is potentially an embarrassment. You know, slide him out the back door as quickly as you can and get rid of him. You know, but we don't know the integrity of their judgment either. You know, we don't know the information that they were relying on, and therefore we're leaping to an assumption that this was something really quite horrendous, and it may have been, and it may not have been. It may have been a foolish indiscretion. We don't know whether Niall O'Donnell knew the age of the person that he was communicating with. We don't even know the objective that he had in mind through those communications. We're making assumptions there that it was related to some degree of closer intimacy, but we don't know. So yes, you're absolutely right. But I mean, I take Brian's point. I mean, essentially what you're doing, Brian, is you've got a news angle here on this that gives you the opportunity to promote the issues you're concerned with. And they are valid issues and valid concerns. And you're doing a grand job as a PR device. It's a very good move because you get a headline around the portrait, and then you can lay out all your concerns about triggering and about abuse and about power differentials between older people and younger people and whatever. And that's well done. You know, you're doing a great job. But
I think that's grossly unfair. I think that's grossly unfair. The public have a right to hold their elected representatives to the highest standards,
and
they have and to have,
they do have the mechanisms for doing
they have
that.
To have confidence. They have to have confidence in the people that they elect, that they can be trusted, and not be worried about child safeguarding issues. So I think that there has to be a standard that we present when we come to the brand of Belfast City Hall. Belfast City Hall presents itself as a council for all of the citizens of Northern Ireland, and the portrait of Niall O'Donnell has a really prominent position at the council debating chamber, so it does. And there are people see it, there are people take tours, there are people get it explained to them. And the image of Belfast City Council is damaged when we say that this is our past Lord Mayor. He resigned from politics because of inappropriate behaviour towards a child. We don't know, I agree with you, we don't know the ins and outs of all of this. But we have to get it right. We have to present the right image to the public.
But Ron, are you uneasy talking about the inappropriate texts when you don't know what they are?
We don't know the ins and outs of a lot of these scandals as they develop. And there have been accusations of inappropriate behaviour across the board. But what we know is that Sinn Féin lied from the start of this for some reason, or they attempted to cover it up. We know that Niall himself has described it as inappropriate behaviour, worthy of standing down. We know that there was a police investigation into it. We don't know the outcome of that or why the case was dropped. But we have a responsibility.
Sorry, hold on a minute. Yes, we do. So the case was not dropped. The case never started because the recipient of the inappropriate messages told did not want the police to be involved.
That's right, and we don't know the reasons for that. We don't know why he didn't want the police to be involved. But again, as part of a Belfast City Council, we have to hold ourselves to the highest standards. And we have to say, is it right that this portrait comes down? Yes, it is, because we have to be stand strongly on child safeguard
members, issues. Your former Lord Mayors who were associated with the UVF and endorsed the activities of the UVF, your former Lord Mayors who were members of Sinn Féin and in the past had endorsed the activities of the IRA. You know, if you're going to look into the thinking and the moral character of one Lord Mayor, then it's only fair. You know, others are going to come up and say, well, if you dropped him, why? What about him? What about that mad evangelical who was homophobic? You know, they're going to say all kinds of things, and they're going to challenge the right of others to have their portraits there. You don't know what you're unleashing here. There's an historical value to the portrait. I don't give a hoot about Neil O'Donnell as a person or about his portrait, but there is an historical value to the portraits on the wall of the City Hall, you know, because they record the progress of the evolution, the political evolution of the City Hall, and they record the people who played their part within that.
Richardson,
and you tamper with that. Don't tamper lightly with that.
Richardson, Belfast. Morning, Richard.
I'm just
hearing, by the way, that the Ulster Unionist Party do support the other parties and do want the portrait to be removed. Go ahead, Richard.
Stephen, as far as I'm concerned, the man has not broken any law, and he was Lord Mayor. Do we get a group of cross-party MLAs and they do an audit of every statue in Northern Ireland and on moral grounds decide which should stay up and which should come down? Do they go to every council area and look at all their portraits and decide who stays up and who comes down?
Nonsense.
Exactly the problem.
Absolute nonsense.
Well, that's a question for you, Ron McDowell.
And people are doing that across the province. We have questions and debates about statues in Northern Ireland and legacy now almost every day. But we deal with the case that's in front of us. There's a case in front of us where we had a Belfast Lord Mayor conducting inappropriate behaviour towards a 16 or 17-year-old boy. And is that the conduct that we expect from our elected representatives? And it's certainly not. And it's not the image that Belfast should be presenting itself with.
Okay, 03030 80 55 55. We'll pause there. Let's get the news from the BBC. Right, good morning. You're continuing to call us today, Brian. Next morning, Brian.
Good morning, Stephen. Stephen, yes, Sinn Féin totally mishandled this whole episode. Totally. And that's my views on it. But what's that saying, Stephen? People in glass houses shouldn't throw stones. These nine were, what, no, we're getting nine. Certain politicians playing politics. They've seen an opportunity. I'll say this, especially the TUV. Especially TUV. They see an opportunity for getting their name out there and being the good guys. And, I mean...
Well, do you not want your elected representatives commenting about the news, commenting about issues? Do you not think the safeguarding rules and protocols and processes around political parties are an important thing to talk about?
Anything that affects children and the way it's been and what's been said and done by individuals, it's terrible. And I will make the voters now will make their mind up. And I've made my mind up. So I'm a voter of Sinn Féin, but I've made my mind up what I want to do now.
Well, what's that?
I probably not be voting for them.
Why?
Because anything to do with children, they mishandled it completely. Instead of coming out first thing, the first news they got from individuals, about individuals, has sort of been told right away, and whatever the system they have within political parties, instead of this, that thing's disappeared. It mightn't come up in news and people mightn't find out. And that's what I'm hearing. I mean, but let's now get, it's gone on too long now, Stephen. People are fed up with it. And I mean, what I found strange too is 4 or 5 years, 10 years ago, the same thing. The government would have, the Stormer would have failed. Now, they're not even calling for that there, which is a good thing too. I don't want to see it fall. But as I say, they're playing politics, and it's very annoying to hear individuals on when we know, and not just me, I talk to people where I live, and they're just playing politics with us. It's gone on too long, Steve.
Do you want to respond to this, Ron?
I don't think we're playing politics. Everybody has known the TUV's position on a whole range of issues for years. And the safeguarding issues that he's raising as a concern, that's what we're doing. We're raising them as a concern.
But Ron,
around Stormont in particular, one of the things that you said about you don't want to see it brought down, but the mechanisms at Stormont at the minute, the TUV who have a vote of no confidence in Michelle O'Neill, for all of those issues that you've just highlighted there, all those concerns that you have,
but Ron,
people can't sign that.
Ron, listen, let me tell you, I know that the TUV always did want Stormont to fall. Your leader has always stated that, even in government. So we know what you're all about, the TUV.
Yes. We're not going to hide and say we don't want rid of Stormont. We don't think Stormont's delivering. But what we're talking about at the minute is a consequence of the setup of Stormont. You can't criticise those in government. So the TUV have a vote of no confidence in Michelle O'Neill, hiding from these questions around children's safeguarding issues, child protection.
Well, Michelle O'Neill would say that she's hiding from nothing, and she's answered many questions.
But the other parties can't sign a vote of no confidence in her. So they have to have confidence in her.
Well, they
can.
They're choosing not to.
And why do they choose not to? Because it means bringing down Stormont. So that means there's no accountability in government. And that's one of the principles.
So you think there's no accountability in any government unless it collapses?
Well, then 3 weeks ago, not unless it collapses, around the systems that are set up within it. So you should be able to have no confidence in your government. It's called holding them to account. You should be able to question them for more than 30 seconds at committee level around these issues. And when we question them and when we say we have no confidence, not one other party can say the same thing, because they're afraid that the consequences of that will be bringing down Stormont, which tends to that Stormont is set up wrong.
Gareth, morning, Gareth.
Morning, Stephen. As the previous callers have said, or some of them have said...
Just before... Sorry to cut across you. I'm just seeing, dropping on my screen here, a statement from the SDLP. They support the removal of the portrait. They say the SDLP supports the removal of this portrait. We also acknowledge the need for a wider discussion around memorabilia at Belfast City Hall. So I think that's a clean sweep now, isn't it? That's every political party in Northern Ireland, UUP, DUP, Sinn Féin. We just don't know about the Alliance Party. We've asked them. So the Alliance Party, the only one now where we don't know what their position is with regards to this portrait, Malachy. Gareth, will come to you in a second.
Well, you know, I mean, I suppose once Sinn Féin conceded, you know, everybody else is going to pile in, you know, and Sinn Féin were trying to deflate, I suppose, the DUP, the whole plan by saying, aye, all right, have it, you know. They'd been in a very awkward position if they opposed it and defended the picture. But I mean, it is fundamentally, I contend, a silly, trite issue. And it opens the possibility of other portraits being contested and the whole system of portraiture of mayors falling apart. It's daft. They shouldn't be doing this.
Well, that's what the SDLP are saying, because look at that second sentence of their statement to this programme. We also acknowledge the need for a wider discussion around memorabilia at Belfast City Hall. So you start with removing Niall O'Donoghue. Is that the first portrait that will be removed from the City Hall?
A lot of people would have objections to Queen Victoria being in front of the City Hall, you know.
I don't think it's a serious statement from the SDLP. Someone once said that everything before but doesn't matter. And what they've said is, we agree that the portrait of Niall should be taken down, but take down all those symbols of the heritage and history of Belfast.
Well, they haven't said that.
They
haven't used the word but.
That's what the statement reads like. That's how you can interpret it, Stephen. They have used this issue to get at the look and feel of Belfast as a historically British town.
Historically British town? What about current present day, what should it feel and look like?
It feels and looks like the representation of councillors that are in it, and the portraits of the Lord Mayors that are along the halls.
My point is, unionism at Belfast City Hall is in a minority, isn't it?
That's right, it is, yes. And so the current and modern look of Belfast is with unionism in the minority.
And what should we do with the portrait then? I mean, all right, David Olagosa said a very interesting thing about the statues that were being pulled down and the dispute over the statue of Rhodes, at Cambridge, that it's not the statue that's the problem, it's the pedestal. You know, and that's a very interesting point. The problem with the portrait is not maybe the portrait itself, it's that it's on a wall and given an honoured position. So there's two things to consider there. Where does the portrait go? Is it to be destroyed? You know, or is it to go into a museum, or is it just to go into storage and be forgotten about and maybe dug up by somebody in a 20 or 100 years' time doing a history of Belfast or whatever? Or is it, you know, and what about the artist who painted this? You know, there has to be some kind of consideration for the feelings of the artist who painted this. He, I don't know who it was. I can look it up and find out. But it was somebody who was respected as an artist, commissioned to do a job, which in its own terms, is a well-done job, is a beautiful picture, you know,
The feelings of the artist are probably the same as the feelings of everyone who has voted for Niall across Northern Ireland. They're probably the same as people close to it. There's just disappointment in there.
You're asking about the feelings, by the way, the Alliance Party now saying they support the removal of the portrait. Yeah. Malachy, you're asking about the feelings of the artist. Should you not be asking about the feelings of the young person?
How would they feel
that this portrait would remain up? It looks like it's coming down, by the way, but...
Well, it's obviously coming down. I think I've never lost an argument on the Nolan Show as comprehensively as I've lost it.
sorry, Gareth, we introduced you and then cut you off. So go ahead, sir.
Oh, that's okay. I'm sorry Malachy's in this position here, but it does look like there's consensus for its removal. But, this isn't really dealing with the core of the problem here. Safeguarding is the most important thing for many of us. Keeping the Assembly is the most important thing. But do we not need to look at the leadership and strategic management of Sinn Féin? Do we not need to look at their national executive, one of whom is a director of publicity, and not a single journalist has asked anything about their director of publicity. Not a single
I actually don't know who you're talking about, so it would be better.
He's part of the collective leadership on the national executive.
Well, it would be better if we had a chat with you, I think, behind the scenes and just got a sense of what you're talking about before we go on, if that's all right. And hopefully that will be all right with you. Just so we get a sense of who you're talking about and what you're saying. It is a live radio programme. Ron McDowell, thank you. Malachy O'Doherty, thank you as well. 03030 80 55 55. I mentioned Nolan Live on BBC One last night. The row over DUP ministers Paul Given, Gordon Lyons meeting the Loyalist Community Council intensified this week. The LCC represents the views of the UDA and UVF. On Monday, Paul Given, the Education Minister, hit back at his critics who were having a go at him in a heated debate at Stormont. He said he would not be making any apology for meeting the LCC after it was revealed he turned down meeting with 205 other groups. He has, however, accepted 324 invitations, to be fair to him, for meetings since taking up office. It's 30 years since the Loyalist ceasefires. So we wanted to stand back from all of this and give time to analysing beyond the soundbite, they've got to go away. Who are these people? Where would they go? How close are they to transitioning? Talking about UDA and UVF here. I asked Jim Wilson, former member of the Red Hand Commando, why is there a need for the UDA and UVF?
That is a copy of Gusty Spence's statement. And in it, I think you'll find a lot of things very interesting. And the phrase all the time is about objecting true remorse. But there's other phrases in that there that the ceasefires are all incompetent because if the Republicans and the nationalist violence stops. That's in one of those paragraphs. And also the number nine paragraph, read it, it's very interesting. But would you rather be sitting here talking to the Loyalist Community Council, or would you rather be sitting here talking to the Combined Loyalist Military Command, who stood down all those years ago? And if I read out the atrocities that have happened, Republicans have killed, and roughly, according to the police, 40 to 45 people since their ceasefire. Do you know that, Alison?
Well, I'm wondering what shades of Republican. We talked about real IRA.
Provisional IRA alone, 40 to 45 people since the ceasefire. We had all the atrocities around Oma, Messines, police officers, and we also had prison warders.
Yeah, that's all the real. That's the IRA,
right,
the real
IRA. And that, yes, exactly. But doesn't matter what IRA it was. Our ceasefire was based on all those premises. In all those situations, loyalism never responded.
And what should we be grateful?
Well, I think we should be, because we could have been, and the conflict could have continued. The conflict could have been worse than what it is today. We could be sitting here talking about war instead of peace. We're talking about peace and people trying to further themselves on in the peaceful way forward. And that's exactly what we're doing in the LCC. You may not know that, but for the last 2 or 3 weeks, you have constantly attacked us in reference to what we are doing, education. We've been doing education for 10 years with ministers, with John Cale, who was in the PUP and brought a booklet out on education, and stuff like that has been constantly going on, but nobody wants to know about it. There was a group of 50 women in Rathcoole today about women's safety being done by an ex-loyalist prisoner.
But it's all undone, isn't it? All of that good is undone. If I'm not talking about you personally here, but if the UDA and the UVF, as Brian Irvine said on both Good Morning Ulster and repeated it, we've done it tonight, that those groups are waiting in the wings, just ready to shoot again. If they determine, because they're judge and jury, if they determine that they're going to become the defenders of this country.
Is that not a bit unreal? When you consider what I've just explained to you that's happened in the last...
So is Brian Irvine wrong?
No, are they not winning? I personally think he's wrong. Because I'll tell you now, the UVF, the UDN, the Red Hon had plenty of excuses to go back to conflict and never used them. So work out now, Stephen, because if Brian's saying that, Brian, that's Brian's own opinion on that. My personal opinion is we're still striving towards peace.
Striving towards peace?
Yes, towards peace.
Why are you not at peace?
But we are at peace. But the problem with it is people... There's criminality out there in loyalist and republican areas. Every time we hear about criminality, it's loyalist.
And to be fair to Brian Irvine, I should say that he was making it very, very clear that he does not think that any loyalist paramilitary group is poised, ready to engage in violence imminently. He was talking about a doomsday scenario, and we should, to be fair to him, make sure you know that. The SLP councillor Seamus de Foyche said on BBC One last night on Nolan Live that he's concerned about DUP executive ministers meeting the LCC.
I think it's very clear for my generation, Stephen, I'm 32. We've had 26 years of a peace agreement in this place that people voted for and endorsed in a referendum and have repeatedly endorsed by electing political representatives, the majority of whom have backed that agreement. That we want to move on and we want to be in a space where paramilitarism does not hold sway over large sections of our society. And unfortunately, at this moment in time, it still does. I was very concerned about the fact that executive ministers are meeting the LCC, and based on the information I received in a Freedom of Information request, there seems to be some sense that they are prioritising meeting the LCC over other groups who are trying to lobby ministers and meet with them on very pressing issues.
Well, two executive ministers you're talking about. You're talking about Gordon Lyons and Paul Given. You were putting the figure out of 200-odd groups that turned down. They'd met 300 other groups.
Even in the example of the communities minister, the Belfast City Council has met with almost every other minister at this point in relation to priorities that matter to the district in Belfast.
I think
we still don't have a date for the meeting with the communities minister, but he's met with the LCC.
Well, the loyalist activist Jimmy Bryson said on the television, loyalist groups can have a positive role to play in society.
Let me say this. Everybody talks about loyalism going away and the loyalist groups going away. The first point in that is loyalist groups aren't a limited company. You don't just dissolve it. It's made up of people. So when you talk about the loyalist groups going away, you're saying the people should go away. Where should they go? go to where? Where are they going to go to? The task is, are the people...
Where are the rest of us?
Exactly. So what is wrong with people who have a background in loyalism playing a positive role in society if they're doing so lawfully? And here's the thing.
If they're doing so lawfully,
so why should loyalism be held to a different standard than the provisional IRA? And on that basis, I actually don't think conceptually that complete disbandment is actually either achievable nor desirable for this reason, because...
Disbandment of a prescribed organisation
it's not desirable in the sense that if those structures can be used for purely lawful means and to influence a younger generation not to get involved in paramilitary activity, they get engaged in education and that type of stuff, that's positive. Now, why should loyalism... hold on a minute. The Provisional IRA Army Council to this day continue to exist. They continue to exist. That is the security assessment of the PSNI of MI5. They continue to exist. Now, if it's good enough for the Provisional IRA to keep a skeleton structure in order to encourage, the security assessment says that the IRA Army Council directs and controls...
The assessment is that the IRA are not involved in paramilitary activity.
Exactly. So if the UVF and the UDA get to a point where they maintain a structure, but they're not involved in paramilitary activity,
But when's that point going to be?
And the Belfast Telegraph crime correspondent Alison Morris on Nolan Live last night says almost 10 years on from the establishment of the LCC, she sees no sign of paramilitary structures being dismantled.
I think there's two separate issues. Do loyalist ex-prisoners, are they involved in positive community work? Well, yes, they are. And I speak to loyalist ex-prisoners who are involved in positive community work on the ground all the time. Should those paramilitary groups still exist? Well, no, they shouldn't. And the LCC, I went to the formation, to the launch of the LCC. I stood there at the front and listened. And at that stage, we were told that the LCC was going to be a vehicle that was going to allow those groups to transition and to dismantle their structures. And that was what the LCC was for. And almost 10 years on, they haven't moved one single iota on from that day. Do you think you're any further on than you were on that day?
John Paul said, we will help to transform loyalism. As he said, once the loyalist leaders step aside, it would step the dissidents. He did not say about decommission or Alison,
should the Provisional IRA Army Council...
The Provisional IRA don't exist.
So you disagree
with... I'm a security journalist. The Provisional IRA are not involved in paramilitary activity. They don't exist.
Sorry, do the Provisional IRA Army Council retain a structure? Well, they're involved in paramilitary... Do the Provisional IRA Army Council retain a structure?
No, they don't.
So you disagree with the Chief Constable, MI5, and all the...
You're talking about it at Chief Constable, three Chief Constables ago.
No. It's the... Sorry,
Sir Templeton said that. That's how many Chief Constables...
It is convenient for the authorities that there hasn't been a more recent security assessment of what the IRA Army Council is.
Maybe people could ask for an updated assessment, and that would be fine if there was. But I mean, I don't believe it would be any bit that would be any different from what I've just said. But what I am saying is those paramilitary groups continue to recruit. Loyalist paramilitary groups have continued to recruit. So as quick as people step aside or move on, go home, whatever it is they do, there's other people being brought in to take their place.
Well, Jim Wilson is with us now. And look, what we've promised as a programme is space to talk about this. Jim, I went to bed last night thinking about this. And you'd said, morning, by the way, good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Stephen.
And you had said that the Red Hat Commando had essentially transitioned, okay? Why have they been able to transition and the UDA and UVF not? What are the UDA and UVF holding out for?
Well, I think that when you say transition, we have got to a point where we have done what we felt necessary. We went the Ulster Volunteer Force and Red Hat Commando went away to Belgium and decided that they would come back and do all the things that need to be done. And a lot of people within the Ulster Volunteer Force have done that. A lot of people in the Red Hat Commando have done that.
What?
Have went back to ordinary civilianization, working within the community, working to do all those decent things that people want.
And I'm not trying to be funny here, but if you're saying a lot of them have, the inference is some of them haven't.
Well, you see, okay. Now, we'll get down to criminality before you bring it in. When we met one of the chief constables recently, we had asked him, right, what did he reckon was the percentage of criminality within the loyalist community? And we were told less than 5%. I personally want no percent. within the loyalist community, criminality. Criminals are criminals. The police job is to take them off the streets. The police job is to find out who they are, what they're doing to our community, and whatever.
Jim, help me with this.
You cannot expect loyalists, ex-loyalist paramilitaries who are trying to move on to go out and do that role because they're breaking the law.
Can you help?
And you don't want them to break the law. You want them to continue on a peaceful protest.
Can you help me with my understanding? Because a lot's been talked about around this LCC stuff in recent weeks about the money. How much money is there still funneling through to ex-combatants who haven't totally transitioned, so therefore there's some type of pseudo-combatant?
Well, Stephen, let me start off with this, right? First of all, the media have constantly been painting pictures of the Loyalists. They have said the amount of money that's gone into the Loyalist Communities Council. The Loyalist Communities Council does not even have a bank account. That's number one. Number two, come around Christmas time, for a lot of years back there, we were getting together and gathering toys up for young children and taking it to the Salvation Army. Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, those things.
So, Jim, I'm not talking about. LCC. I'm talking about people who are in the UDA and UVF. Does the money continue to funnel through, and how much to those people who you would say are genuinely trying to transition? Like, how much are they getting a week?
I couldn't give you an answer to that. That is an open book for people to investigate and want to check and see what money's being given and what money, and that's all being accounted for. And as far as I'm concerned, and all the groups that are doing
What's the money buying?
Well, what do you mean? It's been working within their communities, doing all sorts of transformation work within their communities, creating things around the 11th and 12th that take kids away from doing things that they shouldn't be doing at interfaces, they shouldn't be doing at bonfires. All sorts of stuff like that has been happening. Stephen, this is the point, and I'd ask you a lot of years back, you need to come and see for it for yourself. I can take you around to areas where UDA are big in doing their community work, the Red Hand are big in doing their community work, and the UVF are big in doing their community work. Let's look at the good side of loyalism, and let's see if people can turn in and help us to move on. Because it's not as simple as what go away. Because I don't know where this place go away is. Because I'd love to be there at that go away place. But we can't seem to be able to do that. We're also forgetting too, Stephen.
So how do I know, Jim?
Assume you're dealing with conflict, right? We have a conflict, God forbid, that's still going since 1948 in Israel. And look what's happening there. See here, our conflict is over. Our conflict is over. We are trying to move the opposition where the people who were engaged in that conflict do nothing but
Jim,
solely
let's say, let's say I took you up on your offer and I went out and I met some people who are in the UDA and UVF, right? How would I know whether I was meeting someone that was spending every day trying to improve their community, that part of the UDA, or how would I know if I was meeting up with a person that when they leave me, they're walking into businesses on the likes of the Shankill and saying, here, give me a brown envelope or you'll be burnt out? Because it's still happening to this day.
Stephen,
It's still happening.
I know that. But the point of the whole thing is, and the point around what happened in the Good Friday, is trust. You need to trust those. I believe I'm genuine enough. I've been on your programme since I don't know when I've come. I'm fed up listening to a number of times we've argued. But the real pointer is, if we really want our society to work and come together, we need to respect the both of them. And remember this, Stephen, and when people tell me how far Republicans have went and where they are and all the rest of it, Tony Blair, the Prime Minister, was said to and David conveyed this back to us, that Tony Blair would look after Republicans and the Chief Constable would look after laws. You've heard this phrase before, but what has that done to my community? It's allowed drug dealers, it's allowed gangsters, it's allowed all those sort of people to infiltrate. Meanwhile, back at the ranch, Tony Blair has politicized and supported and helped and worked and done everything could do to stop the Republicans from going back to war.
What we're going to continue to do here on The Nolan Show and you can't say we're not, is make sure that your opinions are heard and we'll let the public react. Thank you again, Jim, for coming on. Good morning, everyone. It's the Nolan Show from the BBC. You'll be hearing across the news today, both here locally and nationally, that the One Direction star, Liam Payne, has died after falling from the third floor of a hotel balcony in Buenos Aires. Police say they were called to the hotel after reports of an aggressive man who may have been under the effects of drugs and alcohol. And we know that Mr. Payne fell from the balcony after officers arrived. What I want to do this morning is that the BBC is now reporting two emergency calls which were made from the scene. These are the transcripts of them. I'm going to read them to you. There were two calls made from the hotel to Argentinian emergency services in the moments before Liam Payne died. And I'll read it verbatim. 911, what's your emergency? Hello, good afternoon. I'm calling you from the hotel, which is located in Costa Rica. Is that between Kramer Street? And yes, that's correct. They talk about the street. We have a guest who's high on drugs and who's trashing the room. So we need someone to come. And the operator says, understood. So you're telling me he's being aggressive. Sir, can you please repeat the name of the hotel? And the line cut out. There is then a second call that is made. Let me read the transcript to you. And this is the transcript. I just called you but got cut off. I'm calling from the Hotel Casur at Palermo in Costa Rica. Costa Rica Street. What's happening at that location, sir? And the person making the emergency call says, well, we've got a guest who's had too many drugs and alcohol, and when he is conscious, he is trashing the entire room, and we need you to send someone, please. And the operator asks, he's under the effect of alcohol and drugs, is he? Yes, correct, says the caller. You said Costa Rica Street, at which location? And the caller gives the location, and they clarify the location. And then the person making this emergency call says, we need you to send someone urgently because I don't know whether his life may be in danger, the guest's life. He is in a room with a balcony and we're a little afraid that he... And the operator interrupts, since when has he been there or is this a long-stay hotel? He's been here for 2 or 3 days. Understood, says the operator. You wouldn't know any other details because you can't get in, right? No, confirms the caller. We'll notify the same medical emergency staff as well, asks the operator. Yes, says the caller. What I'm asking is for someone to come urgently because... And they then confirm that they are the chief receptionist. And the call goes on. The caller asks, are you sending the police or not? And the operator says the police and the local authorities. And that is the transcript of the call that we have at the moment that the BBC is reporting around the death of the former One Direction star, Liam Payne, who has died after falling from a hotel balcony in Buenos Aires. And obviously, there'll be continued coverage of Mr. Payne's death here across the BBC. Now, next, the Commissioner for Older People and HNI are calling for Northern Ireland's ageing population to be prioritised in the programme for government. Eddie Lynch has criticised the draft programme for government, stating it shows a, quote, blatant absence of policies and considerations for the ageing population. He's with me now. Good morning, Eddie.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So what do you specifically, because look, everything's competing against everything else in Northern Ireland at the moment, isn't it? So what specific priorities do you think should be in that programme for government?
Well, Stephen, I think it's important to stress to your audience that this is the key document of government here. It sets out the key priorities for this executive and where it's going to aim its priorities over the next few years. And the current draft document has hardly any mentions of older people specifically. And I believe that's a major omission and a major mistake, because the demographic change in our society is one of the key issues that we're dealing with. And my strong statutory advice to government has been, we need to look at things in the round when we're designing or reforming our public services. The ageing population has to be central to that, because it affects, and this is not something that affects just older people, this is something that I'm saying affects everybody. Because if you look at the issues that come on your show, health issues, waiting lists, poverty, the workforce, housing, these are all issues that are affected by our ageing population. And what I'm saying is all of them need to be, have to be designed through the prism of an ageing population.
But is that broad brush approach going to cut it, Eddie, in an environment where there is so much pressure on the budget here in Northern Ireland that it is down to a list of priorities punching through? So surely, you know, of course you're the Commissioner for Older People, you're going to say older people should be a priority. But if this is to be meaningful in government policy, surely you've got to be specific. Like, what do you want government to do this year, next year, year after? What do you think the priority should be? They can't do everything for every old person. So what is at the top of your list?
Well, what I'm saying, Stephen, is take the health service. There's talk in the programme for government about improving the health service. But the absence of the ageing population, we are not going to be able to improve the health service for everybody if we don't consider it through the lens of an ageing population. Because the health service is getting worse because we're an ageing population, because there's extra demands on it. Yet the plans for to reforming that isn't looking at the ageing population. And it was only last week we had Professor Ben Goa back over in Northern Ireland. And one of the interviews he did, he raised this issue. He said that unless the demographic changes in Northern Ireland are at the heart of health reform, we're not going to make things better. So what I'm saying is, my strong advice, and you know, the reason I've come together with HNI, we don't normally come together in joint campaigns, but we are seeing this as a major flaw in the plans going forward for the Northern Ireland Executive. And we don't believe, unless older people are at the heart of this reform process, that all these key issues for our society will improve.
Like, for example, John Compton, who was the former head of the Health and Social Care Board in Northern Ireland, was on Nolan in recent days. I can't remember what that was. It was a couple of days ago. And John was saying that one of the big concerns for the health service should be the number of people as they get older getting dementia. And how are we going to cope with it? That ageing population living longer, and as they live longer, statistically, more and more of them are getting dementia. So that's about quality of life. That's about someone with dementia not being isolated, sitting without a care package, unable to go out. And like, does it get more important than that for our mums and dads, our grannies and granddads?
Exactly. And dementia is now the biggest killer in the UK. And, you know, these are the things that we have to grapple with. We have to make people's lives as positive and as healthy and as independent for as long as possible. And that will benefit everyone in society if we do that.
But Eddie, I don't want to be crass about this. I really, really don't. You know, I'm 50 odds. I'm getting into the older category now. I've got an elderly mother, and I'm not trying to be offensive. But in a society where the health minister, Mike Nesbitt, for example, has got to make really, really tough decisions, do you push money into 20 and 30 and 40 and 50 year olds, prioritise them over an age group that are and look, this is crass. But how much money do you give to a 20, 30, 40-year-old that if the operation or the healthcare is successful, are going to live a lot longer, have more years of output, quality of life, than the elderly population? And it is crass. But is that where we're at now?
Well, where we are, Stephen, is where most countries around the world are facing an ageing population. And the advice And the research is very clear. The best way to manage that situation is to keep people active, healthy and independent for longer. That is the secret to it. That we have pressure on the health system so the older people don't need hospital as much as they would if we ignore this. But the bottom line at the moment is we are really struggling in major areas of our health system. But it's also why that what does it mean for our economy? What does it mean for our workforce? Our housing stock here isn't suitable for an aging population. And that just doesn't affect older people. That affects many younger people who are looking to get on the housing ladder. So that is why I feel that the aging population needs to be in the programme for government as a 10th priority. There's 9 priorities in there. There's room for one more. And I think it would really strengthen the programme for government if they make the aging population a key priority in the years ahead.
Should there, Eddie, because statistically, someone who's elderly will statistically be more likely to avail of the services of the NHS than a younger person. As we get older, we get frailer, we need more and more healthcare support. Because that's a fact of life, should those elderly people who have the means to pay be paying more? Because they're using it more.
Well, I think the NHS...
Should there be a conversation around that?
Well, I think the conversation about free healthcare is a flawed one, to be honest, Stephen, because if you actually look at older people have to pay for a lot of their health needs in later life. For example, if you end up in a care home, you're actually paying a huge amount of money if you have assets to that. So this idea that people are getting free health care and free social care entirely is actually very wrong. Actually, older people and their families contribute a lot to providing that service. But these are all discussions we need to have. We need to see what is the best way of funding our health service in an aging population. So yes, of course, we need to be sensible with this, but we also need to ensure that the focus is on providing a better system that supports an ageing population and helps a lot more people live longer and healthy.
You mentioned care homes there. You know, because we've had many conversations both on air and behind the scenes, the Nolan Show did extensive investigating into the quality and standard of care in many care homes throughout Northern Ireland, and we reported on how elderly people had been abused and neglected, and some care homes covering up what they'd done, just not happening to write down incidents, and so it goes on. Elderly people left with bruising and I guess I'm asking, has it got a lot better?
Well, yes. I mean, I think over the last number of years, we've seen a lot of positive changes to the care home sector. I've worked very closely with authorities over the last number of years, and I'm really pleased to say that there's a new, really important in the Adult Protection Bill, which is very close to going through the Assembly, that will provide much stronger legal protection for any vulnerable adults.
Unfortunately, Eddie, your mobile's breaking up. We'll see if we can get fixed. Michael Monaghan, former chair of the Pensioners Parliament. Morning, Michael.
Morning, Stephen.
Good morning. So, look, I'm not trying to be offensive. Eddie's doing his job. He's pushing for older people. But should you get special treatment or should you be in the mix like everybody else?
Well, that's what the First Minister said, that older people will benefit from the improvements in the 9 high-level items that they've identified already. But there are a number of issues or things that we believe should be in the programme for government that are not, don't have any cost effect on the budget. And that's... For
like instance, what?
Well, the age discrimination in goods, facilities and services. In the programme for government 2011-16, First and Deputy First Ministers put a written statement to the Assembly agreeing, that's the two main parties, that they would go out, that they would introduce age discrimination legislation from 16 up. It was consultation, and then it went into the ether. And it hasn't been, you know, it was dropped out of the next programme for government, and then they slipped it in after complaint into the active ageing strategy, and it's not even mentioned now, right? And it's the only area of UK and Ireland that do not have protection for outlaw age discrimination in goods, facilities and services. That's one. You look at, for instance, the things in the health service, and nobody has touched
them. So what can happen here? Make that real for me, Michael. So unlike everywhere else, you're suggesting the protections everywhere else. What can actually happen to an older person here where they're protected from it elsewhere?
Well, there's widespread discrimination against older people in the areas of health and in other services. I've seen it myself, and even where you cannot get access to insurance because you're over 80, right? And I'm in that category, right? And I went to when my insurance increased from £900 a year, and the quote on my car from £640 to £1,319. I went to the websites like MoneySupermarket.com, etc. And that, and two of them produced a list of about 50 companies. Right, half of them wouldn't even quote because it was over 80. Now, that's one example. I can give you an example of the Cabinet Office, no less than the Cabinet Office, targeted people over 80, right, querying whether they were still, to prove that they were still alive so that their pension would continue. Now, they didn't do it for the 70s. They didn't do it in England. They didn't do it anywhere else. But they've done it in Northern Ireland because there was under the age discrimination in the UK, the rest of the UK, the Quality Commission confirmed to me that it was blatant age discrimination. Now, they backed off and really compensated people who had spent money on getting their evidence of survival letter signed by a doctor or a solicitor. And the other one they asked to sign it was a JP that hasn't existed in Northern Ireland since the mid-90s. So the people in the health service tell us that there are decisions being taken on older people on the basis of their age. So this is a protection that we should have here. The parties did agree as far back as 2012 to include this in a programme for government and still haven't delivered on it.
Okay. Michael, thank you. Eddie Lynch, thank you very much indeed. Good morning to you both. 21 minutes past 10. New plans from Labour could see unemployed people living with obesity given weight loss jabs in order to get them back to work. Health Secretary Wes Streeting claimed that jabs could kickstart a major back-to-work drive and boost productivity, with weight-related illness costing the economy $74 billion a year. The Prime Minister said the proposals could be very important for our economy and health. Commentator Emma Wolfe with us this morning. Morning to you, Emma.
Good morning, Stephen.
Good morning, good morning. Northern Ireland Conservative Matthew Robinson. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Stephen.
Is there a need for this, Matthew? Is it the right way to spend money?
Well, credit where credit's due. This is a creative idea. I think, obviously, it's worth selling anything that will put.
Matthew, you're on that dopey FaceTime thing, which is breaking up. We'll see if we can come back to you. Emma, what do you think?
Well, look, obesity, I think, is the number one health crisis of our times. We haven't talked about this properly, and we are facing a huge, huge cost to the NHS, billions and billions it costs them every year. Wes Streeting has the right idea. I find it slightly odd that Keir Starmer stood up and basically announced a £300 million investment project with Eli Lilly. They want to get 1.2 million people onto these weight loss jabs over the next 12 years within the NHS. So that is a good thing. I think in terms of the economically inactive...
Is it the women?
I've got reservations about the jabs, Stephen. You know, we talked about this as MPIC, Wegovy, Moundjar, this new one. There are major reservations in my mind because I'm not sure this is the way to tackle obesity. I don't think that giving someone these miracle weight loss jabs, which, by the way, have a lot of unpleasant side effects, and I've spoken to people who are on them as well as just... the data that we have. We don't have enough research. We don't have enough years of research into this. And I do think people need to learn how to, fundamental lifestyle change, eating more healthily, doing the boring stuff, doing the exercise, more activity in your day. But in terms of getting people off that terrible spiral of, morbid obesity or just being overweight and economically inactive, not working, which is depressing. It makes you want to eat more. It is a real cycle of downward cycle of depression and despair. So I do think it can give someone a kickstart into working again, getting active, eating more healthily.
Matthew, I know you're back with us. It's whether in an environment where budgets are tight and decisions are being made what not to spend money on, this is a good spend of public money.
Well, I think this is exactly the point. And my concern, and while I think it is a creative idea, and there has been some clinical evidence to show that this drug is quite effective, I do worry when the NHS has been squeezed, we're hearing all sorts of doom-mongering from Labour as it relates to the budget. Is this a fair use of NHS resources? Is it fair to channel what limited funds, extra funds? Is it fair that this drug, effective or not, is only reserved to those on this trial basis that are unemployed? I think a lot of people that pay into our social system will ask, well, why is this not available to me on our public healthcare system? So my other concern is I think this has been rushed out with little planning from Labour. I'm skeptical as to some of the details. I think Labour are still trying to figure out some of the details as they throw together this shambolic budget.
Why, Emma, should it be people who are unemployed getting it? I pay my taxes. Why shouldn't I get it? I'm fat. Why shouldn't I get it?
Well, I suppose the assumption is, you know, in terms of unemployment benefits and the overweight and the obese, it's costing the NHS a huge amount. The amount of inactivity is costing the country billions every year. So I suppose that's the rationale. But I would agree with Matthew, actually, in terms of, you know, the long-term planning. Where does this go? Are we going to have people on these jabs for life? Is it going to be a 3 to 5 year thing? How long are they going to need to take them? Are they going to, will they regain the weight after? Because I don't think you've then learnt necessarily, you've learnt a new healthy lifestyle to keep the weight off long term. Maybe we don't have the data. There are a lot of questions on this, but it may be for some people. So Stephen, Robert Jenrick, for example, the Tory leadership contender, he said that he took them for a couple of months, lost about 4 stone, didn't like the side effects. So he took Wegovy or Ozempic, didn't like the side effects. So now he's eating healthily, he's doing more exercise. So he'd stopped taking them, but it kick-started that recovery. And I think when you're unemployed and overweight, that could be, you know, that could be a way to get you moving.
I can't avoid this man, Pat the taxi driver. I was pulling in the garage yesterday to get my car filled up with petrol, and there he was at my windscreen. I actually had to put it down, and here he is ringing my programme now.
And Stephen, may I add, the state of that car with prawn cocktail crisps and chocolate bars.
Mind your business.
Chicken takeaways was ridiculous.
What was he buying?
Hold on. What was he buying? He had chicken takeaways. He had burger boxes. He had crisps, bars of chocolate, and the Royal Enfy. But why I phoned, I was listening to our...
Tell you what, I need to put sunglasses on with this sheen from your turkey teeth.
Yeah, and your own turkey teeth weren't too bad. You would have thought you would have spent the money for the bottom ones.
They were whiter than a polar mint.
Right, let me get to the point.
You're obviously doing a roaring trade in the cab business in Belfast.
I have to tell you, it's the money I get for coming on the Nolan Show because I'm in the post all the time.
We're all getting our teeth done on these
bees. Stop your waffle. And for anybody that's going to start writing in all these complaints, Pat gets no money.
Stephen, you should be on your bike. You should be on your bike, not in your car.
Stephen, we know you've tried the things. We know you've tried to keep fit. We know you've got the Botox. We know you got the teeth replaced. What would you think of getting these weight loss injections? Weight loss injections. You're a multimillionaire. You don't need the government to give you them. You can afford them. Why would you not get them?
As illogical as it is, given the kick I put into my body in terms of eating, I would be concerned about putting something artificial into my body. It's not logical.
What about all those numbers that you put in, even from all those chocolate bars?
It's not
sweets.
Logical, but I don't know what these jabs do. I don't know how much research there's been.
Would you not do a trial, Stephen? I think I did.
Should I be a wee rat?
For all the people.
Just call me a rat. Certainly, I'll be the trial.
Yes, biggest show in the country, and then the people would see, my God, look, Stephen Nolan did this, I'm going to do it. You think of many people you could help throughout this country.
I should add, before any of this medicine will be put into circulation, of course, there will be many trials that will have been done on it, but always consult your doctor. Do you not think you should insist on trying to do it the natural way, Pat?
Stephen, you've tried it. You've trained. You lost stones upon stones, and then you went back and ate those chicken again. You know, every time they see you, you're beating the chicken until you're beating the prawn cocktail. Why don't you try the injections? I'd love to see you nice and thin and fit, and none of us would be worried about you. Dan, you think about the amount of people that phone into you, all those old ladies, worried about your health whenever you get a wee pain in your side or a wee pain in your back or hurt your toe whenever tiles fall on it. You know, would you not try it, Stephen? You can afford it. You're a multi-millionaire.
Much did your teeth cost you?
Well, you should know. You paid for them.
How much did you pay? Come on.
You paid for them.
How much did you pay?
I got them. They were a gift. They were a gift from one of your producers.
He's just winding it up now. That's what he's doing.
I'm not. Go you and ask your producers.
Thank you,
the
Pat.
The check is in the post.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you, Emma. Thank you, Matthew. He's off his rocker this morning, that Pat man. We'll see you in the morning.
On BBC Sounds, tweet at Stephen Nolan.
What are the most memorable travel adventures? Those where we open our eyes and our minds to new experiences. It's all to see here in Azerbaijan. New flavors, a new appreciation of ancient history, of natural beauty and of rich contrasts. This is a world of culture, cuisine, wellness and adventure, all yours for the taking. Thought you knew Azerbaijan? Take another look. To plan your Azerbaijan adventure, visit azerbaijan.travel.
I'm Lucy Hawkins from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at disinformation online and its potential influence on the upcoming US presidential election. Why people fall for online conspiracy theories and what happens when real-world events are shaped by online disinformation, and how AI could affect the result of next month's election. The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.